My name is Jeffrey Burke, and I'm the host of the Staying Healthy Show here on KLAV.
Well, today I'm going to be talking about blood sugar, but I'm going to be talking about it in kind of a different angle. I think one of the biggest problems we have is that so many of us are seriously in the sugar addict situation. And, you know, a lot of us jokingly call themselves sugar addicts. Well, you know, we kind of laugh about it. You know, there is some truth to this and the notion that sweet foods are actually addictive. If you've ever known anybody that was a so-called chocoholic, you would know that you've heard stories that they've told you about being in bed and thinking about chocolate and getting up and going in the middle of the night and going to get something sweet and going to get some, you know what, just thinking about the things that are, you know, chocolate-based. I know people that have had, friends of mine who have had chocolate problems over the years, and they'll get up during a hormonal time and, you know, they'll get up in the middle of the night, get in the car and drive and go to wherever's open to get a chocolate fix. Now that is a pretty good grasp over us and a pretty good hold on our being, if you will. How does this happen? I mean, does it happen because of the chemicals that are used in it? Do we kind of get a mind-altering situation from the sugars that we are eating? Do we get it because of the fact that, you know, it never really satisfies the body, or you get up in the morning and you have a bagel or something sweet or a Danish or a candy bar, God forbid, and then you get going and then you just get to where you're going at work and then you feel tired again, so you reach for a cola or you reach for a really heavy sugared coffee, or you hit the vending machine and you get a little boost from that, and like an hour later you're feeling down again and then you reach for something else. Was there ever a time when you would eat just one little piece of sugar and it would give you energy all day long? Or is it one of those things that just really just kind of tastes so good and so sweet that you want to just keep that feel-good feeling and that release, you know, of the brain chemical, like the serotonin or whatever we get released when we're eating it? Because I'll be honest with you, you know, eating a bowl of Brussels sprouts is not going to give you the same kind of feeling. You know, and people that do eat a lot of sugar have a tendency to want more of it all the time. And when somebody goes on a program or a diet or a restricted way of eating, or they find out that they're a type 2 diabetic, which more and more and more people are finding out now because of the fact of their overconsumption of sweets and carbohydrates and their ineffectiveness of burning them as fuel and inactivity and obesity and everything else that goes with it. And also the hidden sugars that are in things they really don't, you know, maybe they don't put the two and two together that they're getting a ton of sugar in these products as well. So many people will eat yogurt and they'll think it's good for them. Now, there was a time when plain yogurt was really good for you, but most of the designer yogurts today are loaded with sugar, loaded with corn syrup, loaded with extra sweetened fruit and things to make it taste so good that it really does taste like candy. It really does taste like a treat. It tastes like something sweet. And you know what? It really is. And the actual reason for using it is not as beneficial as it was when it was just plain yogurt that you added your own fruit to. What about all the bread we're consuming? Bread and pasta and rice and potatoes, all of these are processed in the body as sugar. So when people say, well, I don't eat any sweets of any kind, but you know that they eat tons of bread and biscuits and tortillas and chips and potatoes, and they eat all kinds of pastas and rice, they're loading their body with sugar. People that just do this in general will actually have a situation where, you know what? They want it. They crave it. And they desire the more sugar, the better. So when you take it away from them, the cravings and the withdrawal is pretty intense. A lot of people will say, you know, I don't know if I can cut my sugar out. I just don't know. It's kind of like trying to cut out caffeine. Yes, it can be done, but is it a little bit of a process at the beginning? Yeah, it really is. And when you start taking people's sugar away from them, you're dealing with fire. Because people have come to rely on sugar and come to rely on white bleach flour and carbohydrates and, you know, and not really focusing on the whole grains and fruits and vegetables, but the sugar stuff, the sugar candy, the stuff that's sweet, the stuff that we process and that we enjoy so much of, and even the fast food that we're eating now. You know, every single day you're eating the white breads and you're eating the potatoes and you're eating and drinking all of the sugared beverages. Everything has to do with sweetness. They even have now in the pharmacy when you get medicine for your children, They even have the flavorings you can add to them so that your kids will take the medicine, because if they don't taste sweet, they won't use them. Most of the children's vitamins that are on the market through the pharmaceutical companies and drugstores, they're all sweetened with sugar. Well, it kind of defeats the purpose when you're trying to give your kid a vitamin, and most of it is just a sweetened piece of candy. So you have to really realize that there's a lot of things that are changing out there. There's a lot of kind of a momentum toward people getting away from the sugar. It's just a lot of people have not really signed on yet because they're not ready to get away from their individual bad style of eating. So, you know, how do we do it? You know, how do we stop these cravings from being so intense and from causing us to have such amazing amounts of mood-altering and mind-altering situations? Because you really do cause an altering of your mood, a buzz, a high, a natural high, if you think about it, just by having the sugar. Americans consume averaging about 22 to 23 teaspoons of sugar a day, according to the American Heart Association. You know, they recommend that people have no more than 5 or 6 teaspoons in their foods per day. But I think it's a lot higher than that with the people that are using all the sweetened flavored coffees and the amount of sodas that are being consumed every single day. And, you know, we don't just consume sodas like we used to. There was a time when if you got a can of soda or a bottle of soda, it was about 8 ounces, sometimes 6 to 8 ounces. And these days, the smallest soda you're going to get most of the time in a store in a plastic bottle, if you get it at a convenience store, is going to be about 20 ounces. And then above and beyond that, you have the large size soda, the fountain drinks, which are medium large, extra large, and you can barely carry it size. And, you know, people drink these all day long. And then by doing it, what they end up doing is they overload their pancreas, they become diabetic, they become overweight, they become sluggish. They become fatigued, they become tired, they don't produce enough insulin, and then they wonder later why they're so tired and run down and they have no energy. And then what happens is their metabolisms actually start to slow down. So when the metabolisms slow down, we end up having a situation where, you know, if you try to lose the weight, unless the sugar goes, you're not going to be able to do it because your body has become totally dependent. And that's where sometimes going on a cleanse and cold turkey on the sugar is one of the best things to do. I'm going to take a break, and when we come back, we're going to continue with sugar and sugar cravings and maybe get some ideas on how to get rid of some of these out of our diet. Today, we're talking about sugar. We're talking about the intensity of sugar. We're talking about some of the things that we could do that might just make a difference to possibly diminish our sugar and bring us down a little bit with our cravings. Of course, you know, moderation is something that many of us should be focusing on, but that's pretty hard to do when you have a pretty intense sugar craving habit. Now, they've talked about going cold turkey. You know, cutting out some of the sugars works for some people. Some people have to go cold turkey. The first 48 to 72 hours are pretty tough. Other people feel like they have to retrain their taste buds. And, you know, after 72 hours, you know, you have probably gone through even everything from cravings to mood swings to headache and other things that usually ensue when you're trying to cut out sugar if you have a pretty good-sized sugar habit. Once you've gone through the initial cold turkey, or if you're just trying to back it down a little bit and maybe cut it in half or cut it by 75% so you're not overloading your body with sugars and sweets, you might want to think about just starting to increase things that still have a sweetness to them. But along the way, they still have a tendency to, you know, do things a little bit more constructively. Well, I thought one of the best things we could do today is bring on someone who could really talk about sugar and talk about some natural alternatives, because his education and his training and his teaching is always wonderful. And this is a great topic, so him and I have never done this. My guest today is Mark Kaler. Mark's life took a sharp and unexpected turn in the middle of work on his PhD in sociology, as it happens with many of us. A part-time job in a health food store awakened dramatic lifestyle changes and a passion for holistic health and healing. From this point on, he began exploring in depth, and he still does to this day, a diverse array of healing practices and traditions from around the world, from a Cherokee reservation to the Amazonian rainforest to mountains in China. Eschewing a pursuit for allopathic alternatives or symptomatic relief, Mark has been in pursuit of radiant health, both in his own life and practice. practice viewing health and healing as a lifelong process or a path rather than an end goal. While maintaining a private practice, Mark lectures internationally on holistic health and the journey to radiant health while consulting in the natural products industry as an educator and a formulator. I'd like to welcome my guest this morning, Mark Kaler. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning, Jeff. It's good to be here.
Thank you very much. We're talking sugar today and the intensity of our cravings and our demands and our desires for sugar and some of the things that we might be able to do to maybe curtail and cut it back a little bit because we have that huge type 2 diabetic train coming at all of us now, and a lot of it's coming our way because of our choices and our fork and our inactivity and definitely our consumption of carbohydrates and sugar.
Well, I was wondering whether your intro there, how we're really going to talk about sugar, I think is the quote. Is that in reference to sugar cravings and the sugar fiend that I am, or just a more general statement?
Well, you know, that's funny. You know, I think that everybody in general loves things that are sweet. I think the problem is when it overtakes your intensity to the point when you are just out of control with your sugar. There are people out there that know they should not be eating sugar in their diet, and their cravings are still very intense. Diabetics in general are one of the worst groups for cheating on their diet. Of course, kids are eating a ton of sugar these days, and most of the fast food and the food that we're eating every day is loaded with sugar. So I think to a degree, everybody, I mean, I would love everybody to live in the gray area and deal with moderation, but it's out of control for some people.
Yeah, I agree wholeheartedly with that. And the key point there really is cravings. I think sugar needs to be thought of almost as you would a drug. I mean, I've worked with patients for 30-some years now, and I can say one of the most difficult things to get people off of is sugar. It is a very addictive substance. It's a very purified substance. It encourages certain physiological changes in the body that really create that craving, that make you want it more and more. So it's just not a matter of just simple willpower. It's a matter of this highly refined substance being introduced into our body, actually physiologically changing the body, which requires our body or communicates to our body that, well, we want more of this stuff. We got to have more of this stuff to get back to that same place that we did before. So it really is all about the cravings. And the nice thing about it is there are some simple things we can do to help slow down those cravings, to help slow down that blood sugar, and to bring balance back to the body.
You know, I wonder how it all started. How did it get so out of control? Because if you go back, even you study anything, even 30, 40, even 50 years ago, sweets were basically from fruits. Pies were made fresh. The crust were made from grains that they knew where they came from. They used real sugar, but there was no chemicals there. They didn't have any of the preservatives. And, you know, it was really more of a treat. It was really more of something that was enjoyed. And, you know, you worked hard and you had a piece of pie for dinner or you had something that was sweet. But it was just, it's gone from that to leading the actual consumption of our food. Things are actually based on sweetness now.
Yeah, absolutely. I think it was something about 100 years ago, the average American consumed really just a few pounds of sugar over the space of a year. And now I think the average is somewhere around 175 pounds of sugar a year. And, you know, one thing I always wanted to do in giving a lecture would be to come in that lecture with a wheelbarrow with 175 pounds of sugar there to show people how much is the average consumption. It's quite frightening, but you raise a really important question there is, you know, how did all this start? How did this happen? How did we get to this point? And I think a number of things contributed to this. I think the way food has become an industrial element, you know, just something else to be sold, you know, another object to be put out there and manufactured and thing, rather than growing our own food, you know, cooking our own food, things that we grew or things that came from the local market. And this turn towards processed, already prepared, prepackaged, spiked with all sorts of things to either make it more flavorful like sugar and salt can do or to make it more addictive. I honestly think to some degree that it's put in there many times in foods that don't really need to be super sweet, but they know that if they make it super sweet, people are going to want more of it. So it creates more demand for the product. So I think a whole bunch of elements have come together to really encourage the consumption of this type of food. And then, you know, we have sociological things. It used to be that, and I'm not necessarily saying this is the way things should be, but, you know, one parent would go out and work and the other parent would be home and have more time to prepare foods. That's not necessarily the case nowadays, and it's becoming more and more rare. So people have to reach out for foods that you can fix in a couple of minutes rather than you can prepare over a few hours. So there's all these variables and all these elements coming together in the way food is manufactured, how it's being processed. I even think the dark side of it is, as in, you know, there's attempts to make it more addictive. I think some of the food additives that are added along with the sugar increase that addictive craving quality to it. And then the sociological variables all come together to really make this humongous demand for sweets.
Well, you know, it's really interesting. I was a while back, I think it was during the months of the winter last year, and I was actually at the pharmacy, and their registers were broke down, so they had everybody just come to the pharmacy and check in, and there was a woman next to me getting her medicines for her colds for her kids, and it was so funny because they had these little bottles, and she said, "What flavoring would you like added?" And she says, "Well, I want the blueberry and the strawberry and the orange for the other one," and I thought to myself, wow, they even have to make the cough syrups taste sweet.
Yeah, that's me. I didn't know that they went so far as to tailor the sweetness and the flavorings of cough syrups.
But how do you like that?
That's pretty amazing.
It is amazing. And I thought to myself, have we come that far where now even medicine has to have a sugar taste to it? And obviously it has. And, you know, it's funny how they'll even, you know, talk about on commercials on drinks for children. You know, they'll always mention somewhere in there about it being extra sweet, you know, an extra fruity tasting, an extra, you know, and these are things that I think Madison Avenue, they kind of slide them in because they know that the sweeter and the more sugary and the more chocolatey and the more candy-ish, the better it's going to taste, and more kids and more people, and definitely more adults, are going to want it.
Yeah, and that's absolutely the case. You know, it even gets back to not just sugars, it's how we refine our grains. I mean, you know, years ago, wheat would be harvested and it would just be ground up and then baked with almost immediately. And that's not the case anymore. Now it has to be processed. Now it has to be have the bran and all the nutrients and fiber stripped from it so that even things that weren't necessarily naturally sweet have become even sweeter elements in our mix. And that's kind of a sad commentary on the whole processing of food in our industry.
Now, everything that used to be geriatric at one point or another, you know, has now trickled down into much younger years, whether it be heart disease or cholesterol or degenerative bone disease and bone density and all that. Do you think that there is a direct correlation between the way our diet has drastically changed and the incidence now of diabetes, both for adults and children?
Oh, absolutely. And not just with diabetes. The foods and the high sugar foods that we're eating are principal causes for the dramatic increases in the high rates we see of heart disease. We tend to always think blood sugar, oh, that must mean diabetes, and we associate those two together. But high blood sugar rates and high blood sugar or high blood insulin levels are closely correlated to heart attack risk, increased risk of stroke, raises your risk for cancer, certainly ages us dramatically, contributes to fatty liver syndrome, inflammation throughout the body, which we know is a fundamental causal factor for virtually every chronic disease that's out there. So sugar increasing the diabetes rates, which are jumping dramatically. I think the estimate is by the year 2040 or 2050 that the cost for treating diabetes in our country is actually going to be larger than the GNP is itself. So this is a huge threat to the economy as well as to our national health.
Do you know, this is something that's interesting to me. I wonder when it got to the point when it was so hard. You go back 25, 30 years, and I keep reverting back to this because the mentality was different. You went back 30 years, you found out you were diabetic, the doctor told you what to do, you basically did it. We didn't have the people that really extended their flexibility and tried to push the bill as much as they could. Now you find out you're diabetic. The first thing you want to do is you want to find out how far you can push it, how far you can cheat, you know, to still keep your sugar in line. And then you go to the grocery store and you want the mirror image of all the bad stuff you've been eating so you can still have all of that but still stay good.
Yeah, I want to go back a little bit, though, in time. The tendency, too, is to think that, you know, I agree with you to some degree that that's what's going on. But also 40, 50 years ago when someone was diagnosed with diabetes and they were given their medication, they were also told to go out and eat anything they wanted to. They weren't necessarily told to stop drinking the soda or stop eating candy and things like that. So that's one of the amazing things is that even though we knew this was a disease caused by dietary factors, even 40, 50 years ago, all medicine wanted to do was treat it with drugs and not necessarily treat it with the lifestyle changes. So some of these things are coming about because now at least we are talking about the types of foods and things that you're eating. But I agree wholeheartedly. There's a certain indulgence in our culture, and I hate to sound like an old fuddy-dud, but I really think we need to get back to this idea of responsibility and this role in health and healing. I think because of the way the medical system is set up in our country to a large degree, we've kind of absolved ourselves from our own personal responsibility for our health. We don't worry about it personally. We let our doctor take care of it. So when something happens, it's the doctor's fault or it's the doctor's responsibility to get us better. Instead of turning that around saying, first and foremost, it is my responsibility to be healthy. It's up to me to heal myself and to be responsible for that healing process. And that involves the person in the healing process. I think it's very empowering. I think it's a very powerful healing tool to use in the process. I have found certainly in serious cancer cases that I've worked with over the years, that the patients that become very involved in the healing process have much better reactions and results to not only the natural treatments, but even to the pharmaceutical treatment. So I agree wholeheartedly with you that we need to get back to this idea of being responsible for our own health. And I think that plays a real pivotal role, particularly as it relates to type 2 diabetes and these blood sugar conditions, because in the vast majority of cases, this is, I don't want to say it's easily corrected, but we know how to correct it. We know how to turn things around.
Let's talk a little bit about natural alternatives. I want to get your view on a couple of these and have you talk to me about your opinion on these products. Can we talk about Gymnema sylvestre?
Yeah, I like Gymnema sylvestre a lot. I think it has two real particular benefits as it relates to blood sugar problems. And the first is something that's probably going to be useful for a lot of people out there who crave that sweet flavoring. And the simple thing you do is you get a liquid Gymnema product, and you just put a few drops on your tongue, and it will bind to the sweet receptors on your tongue, basically satiating them, telling them that, okay, your sweetness has been satisfied. So it can really take away that oral craving, that oral desire we have for sweets and things. I also think Gymnema sylvestre has a real particular benefit as a pancreatic tonic. I think it has a tendency to strengthen and bring balance and help normalize a lot of the imbalances that are created by these spikes in carbohydrates, which correspondingly relates to blood sugar spikes and then over-insulin production and all the problems that comes with it. So I tend to think of that herb most importantly for those two functions, for helping with sugar cravings and then for bringing balance and energy back to the pancreas and helping reestablish balance there.
Okay, now when is it a time to start using that product?
Well, I would use it, as I said, with the liquid anytime you start craving it. I think if you're just sitting there thinking, you know, I could really go for something sweet right now, I'll make some Gymnema tea or take a liquid extract of it and use it to kind of suppress that cravings and, you know, to satisfy that craving, so to speak. I would use it in any situation where it looks like where there's evidence of the pancreas being stressed, the pancreas having to go into overtime work, and that would be, you know, one of the measures you could do would be to look at your glycosylated hemoglobin, a blood test that's called your HbA1c test, and that's kind of a measure of your blood sugar level over a multiple, you know, of a couple of months, and that'll give you a good idea that, if it's high, it means that your pancreas is having to work a little harder than it really needs to be working, and that's when I tend to bring it into the mix and things, when you know that over a longer period of time, that pancreas has had to, you know, has needed to be working much harder than it really should be. And if you don't want to get the blood test, another thing you can do is just look back at your diet. I mean, if your diet consists of, you know, a lot of sugar on a regular basis, consistent white flour, white sugar products, there's a good sign, you know, that's a pretty strong suggestion that it's time probably to be paying attention to our pancreas. And the key here, too, is pay attention to it earlier rather than later. You don't want to get to the point where your pancreas starts to shut down and it can no longer manufacture the insulin that's necessary for the body, for the cells to utilize and open up to the blood sugar. So it's real important in this case. Prevention, as we talk about in a lot of other cases, is really the name of the game.
Okay, now, if you are a diabetic and you're already on medication, whether it be an oral medication or an injectable, how does Gymnema fit in there? You call it Gymnema, I call it Gymnema. Either one of them, how does it fit in there?
If you're taking medications, what people may notice over a period of time is actually fairly complex. It's going to depend on where they are in the continuum, because when we talk about blood sugar problems, we're talking about a huge array or a huge mix of different conditions that are going on in the body. For some people, it's just a matter of, you know, their blood sugar gets too high at times, and we need to bring that blood sugar into balance. For other people, it's the blood sugar is so high that it's now causing insulin levels to get high. For other people, that has gone on for a long enough period of time where blood sugar levels are so high that we've now started to deplete and tax the pancreas so that it's no longer producing enough insulin. And then the far end would be, you know, the case where the insulin is no longer, the pancreas is no longer able to secrete insulin at all, and you have to use complete external source for that. So it really depends on where you are in that mix of things. Again, I would tend to bring it in when you start seeing signs of stress or indications that the pancreas may be under stress. And it's not one of those things I don't think that you're going to take and you're going to see real dramatic changes or benefits in the next couple of days or so. I think it's one of those things that's going to bring balance and help the pancreas to work at more optimum levels so that over time your body starts producing more insulin, hence you need to use less and less insulin. So it's not something that may change your insulin dose in the first few days or even a couple of weeks, but it may be one of those things that over many weeks or multiple months, you start noticing that you need to use less and less insulin. And that's one of the nice things, one of the measurable things you can that is present with diabetes that's not there with lots of other diseases. It's a simple little blood test. We have these little blood monitors. You do the little prick. It tests your blood sugar level. So you get this oftentimes several times a day measurement of how these things are working for you, and you can adjust things accordingly. And I see Genema really, in my mind, working more in the long-term sense of this.
Okay, so that is step one of this product. Now, can we talk a little bit about something that's got a lot of press, cinnamon?
Yeah, I'm actually a big fan of cinnamon for a number of reasons, beyond just its blood sugar benefits and things. First, it's a very effective antioxidant, and that fits into this whole mode too, because one of the reasons high blood sugar is so damaging and so dangerous to the body is because it's so reactive. It tends to create a lot of free radicals in the body, which can contribute to, again, the breakdown of the pancreas, pancreas death, or the sleeping of the pancreas, so to speak. It can be anti-inflammatory, so it has benefits beyond just the blood sugar. There are more and more studies showing it having these particular benefits that are more specific to helping to control blood sugar levels, and even then some of the corresponding things. You know, I think some of the studies show it lowering the LDL cholesterol, the total cholesterol, even the triglycerides and things. So it has this action of helping to keep the blood sugar levels down, and it shows those corresponding benefits you would expect with it. Key in this process, while I think you certainly can use a cinnamon product that is, you get in the spice rack, I think for therapeutic benefits, what you really want is one of these concentrated ones where they've extracted out what are called the water-soluble components of it for it to be most effective.
Okay. Now, if you, once again, if you are a diabetic already diagnosed, does it fit to your, do you get the benefit no matter what?
Yeah, and cinnamon is one of those things that even if you're not showing blood sugar concerns, but do eat a little more carbohydrate than you probably should, or refined carbohydrates, sugars in your diet a little more than you it really should be. But those are the individuals that I really like them to have a little cinnamon before every meal, because it kind of primes the body to be able to receive and deal with those carbohydrates more efficiently, more effectively, so you don't get the high spike of blood sugar and you don't get that corresponding insulin spikes. You know, it's one of those substances that I really encourage people, again, with the sugar cravings or with these blood sugar problems, to do before basically every carbohydrate meal would be the ideal way to take it, I think.
Okay. So those are two things that people can start using in combination to, they can be combined, obviously.
Yeah, there's no contraindication that I've ever heard of for using these things in combination. And it's probably best to pick the two or three or even four or five of these things to work in the situation, because this high blood sugar and high insulin really is a lot more dangerous than just diabetes. And I don't mean to trivialize diabetes, but the consequences of the diabetes, of the high blood sugar, the inflammation, the free radical damage, the cardiovascular damage, and now we're seeing correlations between blood sugar and insulin levels over time, and you know the occurrence of Alzheimer's and dementia. You know, things that hit us much further down the lines. You know, we really need to be attentive to this and do, I think, as many things as we possibly can.
Okay. Now, if someone is a diabetic and they're diagnosed, and I've always been a proponent of somebody finding out that their sugar is out of control, I usually will ask them to talk to the doctor and let the doctor know that they want to have 90 days to make some changes in their diet before they jump right on medication. And, you know, increasing exercise, changing the diet, getting more live green foods, you know, more antioxidants, and, you know, shedding some of the weight and doing some of these things. Because, you know, in 90 days, you can make a drastic difference in your reading and the actual health of your pancreas. How do you feel about that?
Yeah, no, I agree heartily with you on that, and a good doctor should do that as a matter of course. In the vast majority of cases, when you're diagnosed with diabetes, it's not life-threatening in the immediate sense. So this is one of those conditions. It's a chronic condition. It takes time to develop. It takes time to correct. We have that opportunity to do that. By all means, spend 2 or 3 or 4 months correcting the diet, bringing in the whole foods, the whole grains, the higher fiber content, cutting back on those sugars, maybe, you know, gradually adding in some of these herbs and nutrients we can use to help bring balance to the blood sugar and help the body utilize it better. But that is certainly, without a doubt, the most intelligent way to approach this. So I'm 100% on board with you on that one.
Do you see the signs of diabetes and sugar problems and health-related problems to sugar continuing to increase in this country or maybe leveling off?
To be the pessimist, but I don't see any end in sight at this point. Obesity rates are climbing dramatically, and clearly blood sugar consumption is closely related to this growth in obesity rates. The fact that we're getting less and less exercise and movement, and we're outdoors less, and just moving the body around a lot less than we're designed to and than we used to, that will exacerbate this whole situation. You know, it's one thing to be consuming carbohydrates. It's another thing to be consuming the carbohydrates and then not utilizing them, not getting the body active and burning it. We all know, you know, in the last Olympics, there was all this hoop to do made about Michael Phelps's diet, how he was consuming, what, 10,000 or 14,000 calories a day. Well, he can get away with that because he's also burning 10,000 or 14,000 calories a day. I even work with a guy who exercises, you know, who runs on a daily basis, who goes to the gym 3 or 4 times a week. And the primary reason he does this is just so he can go out and eat more carbohydrates. So it's a two-sided coin. It's not just a matter of consuming these foods and fixing that balance. It's also bringing balance into the activity and the exercise levels that we have.
You know, you hit on a good point. It's like most people are eating like they are an Olympic athlete. You know, they're loading and they're carb loading and they're doing all this, yet they're not doing any of the output. And our bodies are just storing all of this. And, you know, it's just this starvation reflex, you know, from the caveman time, if you will. And we're packing on all these pounds for fear of a famine that really never comes.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I think for a lot of us, too, particularly of your and mine generation, is we're still eating like we were 18 and 21 years old when we were much more active, when we weren't sitting behind a desk and doing those things, and when we had a metabolic rate that was much, much higher than it is now, you know, at our age. So all these things get to the point that you need to be specific to where you are in your life, to what you're doing in your life, to tailor it to the individual as best you possibly can.
What do you think the correlation is between craving sweets and metabolism?
Well, it depends to some degree what you mean by metabolism, but you know, if your body is in this cycle where it's burning calories at a much higher rate than you're actually taking them in, your body's going to crave calories. It's going to crave food. That's generally only the case, though, with those individuals out there. And we all know these people who are thin, who can eat anything they want, and they never get fat and stuff like that. If that metabolic rate is so high, it can crave it can create those cravings and things, certainly for sugar and stuff like that. Conversely, though, you know, the consumption of sugars and those types of things are going to, in many ways, end up down-regulating our metabolic rates. It's going to make the body more lethargic and slower. The buildup of fat in the liver, we talked about, mentioned earlier about fatty liver syndrome. These things are all going to contribute to kind of a slowing of the metabolic rate, a slowing or lethargic quality to the endocrine system, which can manifest certainly in the metabolic rate as well.
Okay, now I got a question for you. This is amazing. I have a friend, and we've all had been friends with her for a long time, and she has been a sugar chocolateaholic her entire life. She's perfectly in shape, exercises, never has gained a pound, and I swear eats more sugar than anybody I've ever known in my life. Now, she's 51 years old now, never had a health problem, went into the doctor last week for an insurance policy and found out that she's a full-fledged diabetic without an ounce of body fat.
Yeah, and, you know, this is one of those things that I see happen a lot. You get people that are so constitutionally hardy, so strong, and so able to grin, bear it. You know, oftentimes they'll have a very low pain threshold. They can just handle a lot of things. They don't get the colds and flus. And even if they do get sick, you know, they may slow down a little bit for the afternoon, but they're back up and at it.
Mm-hmm.
What my experience is and what I've seen over the years is that these are the individuals that do get walloped like this, that something seemingly comes out of the blue and hits them, these serious diseases. And to a large degree, it's almost like the curse of being so healthy and having such a strong constitution, in that you tend to stop listening to what I call the voice of the body. All along, the body's telling us, it's giving us cues and clues and little messages saying that we really need to be doing more of this, we need to be doing less of that, maybe a little more sleep, this is not a good food to be eating. And the constitutionally hardy people tend to just be able to ignore that and just steamroll right through it. And like anything, you know, if it gets ignored, sooner or later, it's going to catch up with you. You can drive in a car and you can hear that little ping, and it's like, well, you know, the car is still moving, I don't have to worry about it. It may not happen for days, it may not happen for years, but more than likely, at some point in time, that thing is going to create a problem, and the engine is going to shut down. And that's what happens in the human body, and it particularly happens in the cases of diabetes, when down to that cellular level, the engines that drive the cell, the mitochondria start malfunctioning, and that starts creating a whole series of problems. The cells are no longer receptive to the insulin, which causes the high blood sugar, which, again, starts contributing to this whole cycle round and round. So it's something I see quite frequently, and it gets back to the whole point that, again, we need to be attentive to our health now, in the present, in the moment, not waiting for things to break down, not waiting for the diagnosis, not waiting for the symptom expression. Pay attention to it now. You know, I always tell people, when is the ideal time to start making these changes? It's when you're healthy and in the present moment, because, you know, like we always say, you know, there's no time like the present moment. So do it now so that 10, 20, 30, 40 years from now, you don't get these diagnoses.
I think we have a lot more control over some of these things, and we're probably more and more responsible for some of these things than we want to credit ourselves for. And I really do think that a lot of it is a choice disease, diabetes. There is a small percentage of people that end up with sugar problems and an overloaded pancreas and a compromised sugar system in their body. But I think more than none, it's us. We're doing it to ourselves. We're basically tailoring our own diabetes.
Oh, absolutely. It's choices as in, you know, what foods do we choose to eat? What foods do we not choose to eat? Do we choose to get up and exercise in the morning? Do we do weight resistance exercise? And then other choices, which get a little more complex, is do we make choices that raise stress levels, or do we make choices to lower stress levels? Do we make choices that are about seeing a situation not as stressful, but kind of looking at it as in the opportunity that could be presented there? Because stress is a major player in this whole process, too. You get those stress hormones going, and that can dramatically contribute to this development of insulin resistance, which, can raise the insulin levels, can raise blood sugar levels, and lead to diabetes, heart disease, Alzheimer's, cancer, and, you know, a number of disorders.
Do you think that there's going to be a point in time when diabetes is going to be so common that most of us have it?
Yeah, and sadly, I think we're knocking on that door now.
Yeah.
I think we're getting really close to the point that diabetes is just one of those things that you have, and it's similar to the aging process, and we've talked about this in other shows, that most of us accept the fact that as we get older that we're going to lose our hair, that it's going to turn gray, that we're going to slow down, that our minds aren't going to work as well, that we're not going to have as much energy, our bones are going to become less dense. We tend to accept those things as just naturally occurring elements of the aging process, which I wholeheartedly believe they are not. They are, getting back to what you were saying, they are all about the choices that we make and how we live our lives. And I think we're doing the same thing with diabetes and these blood sugar-related conditions, that we're beginning to accept these things as just the status quo. And we're going to get to the point, I think, where certainly a good portion of the population will have it. And those that don't will just be ones that are kind of genetically gifted to not develop them.
How do you feel that greens are effective for blood sugar?
the couple types of greens, obviously, the greens that we eat are going to be excellent because they have very low glycemic index. They're very low in the glycemic load. So these are really the perfect foods to be eating. And also, they're the most nutrient-dense foods that are out there. I think I saw a chart recently that had kale as the most nutrient-dense food that in existence that we know of. So, you know, it fits the mold as a superfood or a perfect food because it keeps the blood sugar levels down, it keeps the insulin levels down, and it's extraordinarily nutrient-dense. It's very high fiber. So those things are going to be very nourishing and helpful and certainly preventative in the long run. Taking other greens, some of the superfood greens, chlorella, spirulina, barley grass, wheatgrass, I think those things have benefits more in the systemic application to it. They kind of strengthen and nourish the body so the body's more capable and more able to do what it's supposed to be doing, so it works better and more efficiently and more effectively, you know, in that sense. And spirulina has a particular application in this sense because taking spirulina on an empty stomach can give you a little bit of that energy boost. At the same time, it can kind of, you know, kill the appetite a little bit, suppress the appetite a little bit. So for people who are in that habit of snacking too often or something like that, you know, reaching for 5 or 6 capsules or tablets of spirulina might be a good alternative for them because it'll help with the appetite and it'll give them a little bit of that energy boost. At the same time, you get all the other health-giving benefits of it for the immune system, for cleansing, for building and strengthening the body. So as a food and as a supplement, I think it fits into the mix very nicely.
Would Green Magma fit into that category?
Yeah, absolutely. Green Magma, as I think I've talked about before, is my favorite green food product out there. It's very energizing. It's one of those things, because it's a juice product, it's already been juiced and then powdered for you, that gets into the system very quickly, and a lot of people feel a fairly quick energy lift from it. At the same time, it's going to be so nourishing and building to the body. And I think that's really one of the kind of the tonic approach to this blood sugar problem that we're having. It's really key not to just target blood sugar and target these symptoms and things. If you can go in and bring balance and support to the body as a whole, the body is naturally going to go into a state where it's not craving these things, where it's not spiking up and down with blood sugar and insulin levels. So it'll bring that sort of balance. It'll help at least bring that sort of balance to the body.
Talk just about a minute about chromium picolinate.
Yeah, you know, chromium is essential, obviously, in any blood sugar condition. Chromium, and there are lots of different forms of it. There's chromium picolinate, or I call it picolinate, picolinate, tomato, tomato, however you want to say it. There's a polynicotinate form to it. You can also get it in yeast. So if people are eating brewer's yeast or nutritional yeast, it's one of the highest sources for it, if not the highest source that's out there. But chromium is very important in the mix because it's involved with the cells and necessary for the cells to be able to utilize insulin. So what they have found, actually, in population studies is that if there's a deficiency in chromium, then the body's not utilizing insulin properly, which causes, ironically, the body to produce more insulin, which contributes to then more insulin resistance and kind of gets us back into this whole cycle of things. Chromium plays a really important role in the mitochondria and in the cell itself in helping the body respond to insulin, which then means the body can then absorb and utilize the sugar and burn it for fuel, which is the primary reason it's there.
Mark Haler, thanks for coming on today and chatting. I love having your point of view. I love taking the time to chat with you, and my audience loves you as an educator, so thank you so much.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure, Jeff.
Have a great day.
You too.
Bye-bye. My guest, Mark Haler, today. Mark is with Mushroom Wisdom now. In the past, we've had him on here with Green Foods, and we'll have him on here again. Always a great educator. Good information today. We're talking about sugar and sugar cravings and blood sugar and the pancreas and where we're heading and where we are right now and what we can do to slow it down and maybe even prevent some of it or bring it back in balance.